Okay, so we were just beginning last week to introduce the book of Job. It'll take about 14 lessons to get through all of this, maybe one extra one because we're going to split the introduction up here in two. We just began up with what the purpose of the study was last week. Basically, we're trying to do two things. We're trying to understand the book of Job as a reality. Job really suffered. We also need to understand it in its historical context, you know. What, you know, is he a Bedouin and is he a wise man of the East and, you know, those kind of things, where he lived, and just being careful we understand the time period. And so like when you get to the part where it talks about the resurrection, you're not assuming that he means everything that we mean by resurrection or something along those lines. So we need to understand Job. Job is a real, I believe Job is real. I don't believe it's a kernel of truth. Some would believe this, that's been embellished by later redactors or authors. I don't think he's a folk hero like Paul Bunyan. You know, he's not some bigger-than-life character. He was very real. And so we went through what authorship. We're not really sure who wrote it. We went through things like that. Structure. It begins with poetry, ends with poetry. Begins with narrative, ends with a narrative. In the middle is this poetry that hopefully helps you to feel the frustration. And really the sarcasm and really the harshness of the debate that's going back and forth. I mean, these guys are saying, Job, you are wicked and you have sinned so bad your children have been punished. We don't even know what it is, Job, but we know you've sinned. And Job is saying, you guys are, when you die, wisdom will die. And, you are inflicting me worse than my illness. And stuff like that. And so it is a battle between Job and his friends. But meanwhile, then Job will start with these conversations to his friends, and then he leaves off and starts talking to God, who he really wants to talk to. And he's saying, God, you're inflicting me here, and I'm not sure. You need to appear so that I can justify myself, so that I can show myself to be innocent. So he always goes, he debates the friends, but then he leaves them. He's like, my argument really isn't with you. My debate is with God. And so we went through some of that. Then we got to the themes, and this is where I added some stuff. I did add a section on suffering. I felt bad not even putting that in there. So we'll spend some time on the themes, and we're going to look at them in two different ways here. We're going to talk about them individually, and then I gave you this chart, and we'll go through this, in which I think the themes are related to each other in the book of Job. I thought about this last week, and I said, I need to put this in a way that people can see how everything is related. So I worked on that this week, so we'll see if that works. It may be a one-time-only thing here. So themes of the book of Job. Before we, any questions, comments about this, what we're going to do in here, I hope that you understand Job so that it can inform your own misfortune, your own suffering. That's my main purpose for doing this. So we're going to take time to figure out what Job is saying so that we can then apply it to our lives. And one of the ways that we do that is through the themes. There are certain themes that run through Job that you have to keep in mind while you're reading. First, obviously, is suffering. While suffering is the most obvious theme of the book of Job, it would be a mistake to assume that the purpose of Job is to make sense of suffering. If you sit down with Job and read it in order to figure out why we suffer, you will end as frustrated as you were when you began, and maybe even more so. It is not a book that answers why we suffer per se. It's a book that helps us to understand what to do when there are no answers. How to interpret it when God doesn't give us answers. Okay, I'm suffering. I'm in location A here. I don't want to be. I would rather be in B, but I'm in A. I don't know why, and God is never going to tell me why. But in the midst of not knowing why, here is how I can make this meaningful. And so don't expect that God's always going to give you answers in life. He does not owe it to us, and nor do we need it all the time either. So suffering, it's not a book about how to make sense of suffering. In fact, one could argue that suffering is not the dominant theme of the book, even though of all the themes present, it occupies the attention of most readers. And that's okay. We can relate to suffering, whether it's things aren't going well, or whether I'm physically unwell, or whether my friends have forsaken me, my family despises me, or whatever it might be. It's okay that we link to that, because that's what makes it relevant. We all suffer. However, the relevance of suffering should not overshadow our interest in the meaning of suffering, which is not found so much in understanding it as it is in knowing God. So that if you understand, when you read Job, there is meaning to our suffering, but it doesn't come from understanding what the suffering is about. It comes from knowing God. So I don't know what it means, but I know God, and that's where the meaning comes. So suffering, we don't always figure it out. We never will figure all of it out. This does not make suffering inconsequential, but it does remind us that the book of Job is not ultimately human-centered. It's not a book about us to help us to make sense of everything that we're going through. It's not a book that's necessary, but it does help us. It is God-centered. Yet in being God-centered, the book of Job does not reflect insensitively, it should be spelled differently, to suffering, but cast it in such a light so as to soften its blow and eliminate its offensiveness. Okay. You ever watch them play rugby? Or what do they call it? What are the other Australian rules? Football or whatever. And you watch them play and they're wearing how much padding? As much padding as a t-shirt will provide. You know, and they are doing worse things to each other than they do in football, at least when football players are playing legally. And there is nothing, the blows are serious. There's nothing to soften the blows. Blows are no less serious in a game of football. They're just as hard. They're just as, they could be potentially just as painful. But there is stuff, what, to soften the blow. So the blows are just as hard, the hitting is just as real, but there's stuff to to make the blow, to lessen the impact. It's like my son. Here's another example. My mother and father-in-law have boxing gloves that the kids can play with. What a great toy. So he wants to box. Well, I'm trying to teach him, you have to hit here. You can't hit here. There's no padding here, Shay. And he's coming at people like this. And I'm like, Shay, hit like this. You know, where there's padding, it softens the blow. The other problem is you don't always know where he's going to punch you either. Yeah.
There was a Mache conference this weekend, and it goes to Job, and he uses the example of bringing in a horse. He is the master, he's the trainer, and because of his relationship with his horses, mm-hmm. he can use them in the training of this unbroken horse. And if you put yourself in the position of the unbroken horse, you don't want to be in that arena with 10,000 people. You don't want to be left out of your green pasture, but you're forced into this arena. Why? Because the master has a purpose for you.
Mm-hmm.
You might be frightened. You might, it might hurt a little bit when he's putting the rope on you and you're learning to tolerate things that you wouldn't normally tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
But because the master has needed you to be useful, sometimes we have to undergo. We don't know why, and you can't explain it to the horse. And so it was very, very timely in what you're teaching.
Someone else raise a hand or have a comment. I thought I saw another one. And so if I can make the connection between what Stacy said and what I'm trying to say here is that part of what makes suffering more acceptable is not the fact that God lessens it or that that we can get rid of it, but that we know God. And so there are things. So the blows are serious. When a Christian loses a family member, that's death. Just like when an unsaved member loses a family member, that's death. But there is what? There is the reality of the resurrection that softens the blow and actually overcomes death. So just so you understand that, we're not going to necessarily understand all of our suffering. But in knowing God, we do have things that soften the blow and eliminate some of the offensiveness. Yeah.
Different
church, watching Tristan's grandfather, who was antagonistic towards the gospel his whole life, as he was in hospice care at a place that's not too far from Autumn Ridge. And he's sitting there, I can remember him mumbling, gurgling through all that's going on. He's saying, I don't want to die. He didn't want to die. But after a few more conversations, someone shared the gospel, and he believed in Jesus Christ and was saved, and so he was prepared to die. And I used to doubt or be skeptical about deathbed confessions, but there is nothing about death that draws someone closer to God without the work of the Spirit. Yeah.
Along with that, one thought about what you mentioned, Joel's attitude towards his friends, is Psalm 146:3, who does not his trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, whom there is no help. His breath goeth forth, he returneth to his earth, and that very day his thoughts perish. And as Doug mentioned, I've had a period of time there between pain and the lack of sleep, but I spent a lot of time in the Psalms also. And those verses continue to be a source of encouragement. And one of the things that came out of that, I remember we got hit with a cup in the accident. My first thought was, well, there's a reason for this. I got to make sure that I see God's reason for it. And in just a general conclusion, it's not about me as a human being, but it should be about God. The other thing that, I had difficulty with is being thankful for the pain and suffering. And I think what I've gotten out of that is, and I think we can see in that reflected with Joel, I don't think we have to necessarily be thankful for the very act of the issue we're going through, the suffering and the pain, those types of things. But I think what's important is that we're thankful for the general opportunity because of something that's going to come out of that. And, I struggle with that. Lord, how do you expect me to be thankful for sitting here with this pain?
Right, I can't sleep.
All those things. But I can be thankful for the overall situation because God put us through it for a reason.
Yeah, we don't enjoy pain. It's not like we look forward to it at all. And Christians don't either. None of us are like, oh, God. I mean, there was a tendency, if you would study church history at all, in the early church, if you would read some of the sermons, there are sermons written about it. I think, is it Augustine? I think Augustine delivered a sermon in which he was telling people that you should not be seeking martyrdom. There was this idea in mind that in some circles that it was more noble to go out a martyr, it was more noble to be sacked, than to just die on your bed, and like most people die. And so he's crying, no. It's noble to die for Christ, but it is not more noble to seek out and to suffer that way. It doesn't make one closer to God or anything like that. And so while on the one hand we certainly aren't people looking for it and saying, bring it on, as Grant says, we are people that after it's said and done, we could say thank you for bringing it on. And it is not easy. And if anybody has ever gone through a period of time like Grant, I've done it myself on a limited basis. There's someone else in this room as well that battles with it, where you don't sleep. You go days on end without sleeping. And like Job does, everyone's going to find points of contact here in the book of Job where you can identify with what Job is going through, because Job went through so much, so intensely, that all, oh, wait a minute, that sounds similar to mine. And so I'm thinking in my mind, when Job's talking about that the nights, I wish for the day, when it's day, I wish for the nights. I can remember that situation when I went through 6 days and slept 3 hours. I can remember that. And it helps to make some of this stuff more real. So suffering, it's part of Job. But don't look for, don't turn to Job selfishly and say, I demand answers. That doesn't mean God isn't going to help you through it, but it's not always through answers. Wisdom. Wisdom is another one. I wanted to read something here to you. With all of this in mind, we proceed to the other themes of the book, which are forced upon our attention by virtue of their relationship to suffering. Suffering's kind of the point which we start. Job suffers, and from all that, all these other themes touch. It's kind of like a tree and having branches. Well, the tree is suffering, the trunk is suffering, and all these other themes touch upon and related to somehow Job's suffering. And none of them, and here's where the wisdom of God, here's the struggle for them. As shall be seen, it is the hidden features of Job's suffering which cause a conflict within the minds of Job and his friends. The wisdom of God must be reconciled with the justice of God while giving due respect to the mystery of God's ways. None of the human participants shall get it right until the end, when Job bows before the mystery while acknowledging the wisdom and justice of God. And I would submit to you that even though we have more, we have the prologue, we have the epilogue, we have more information, but if we really reflected on it, we have a lot of mystery about Job as well, don't we? Because we still, if you ask yourself, but he killed 10 of Job's children. Because he was dared? I don't think, that's not why he killed them, just out of a dare. It's not like, I dare you. I double dog. I remember a movie, I triple dog dare you. And so the guy sticks his tongue to the light pole. That's not what's going on here. It's not that God's like, ashamed and has to be bullied into doing this dare. But really, 10 children are gone. And I think some servants and others died as well. So suffering, so wisdom. In a book that is classified as belonging to wisdom literature. Okay, wisdom literature. Let's stop for a minute. Wisdom literature, what is it? What composes the wisdom literature in the Old Testament? Anyone? What are the... Yeah, but what are the books, I guess? Proverbs. What else? Song of Solomon would fit. You know, we struggle with that one. It is definitely poetry. It might be just about the blessedness of the married life and all of that. And so what else? Ecclesiastes. And sometimes we overlook that there are wisdom psalms. That while all the psalms would be considered wisdom literature, some of them are wisdom psalms. And so these are all fit within this category that we lump as wisdom literature. But
with the fact that we are holy and we don't understand God, and when if you read the Bible, joy and singing and praise are all powerful tools, and so therefore they are wisdom. And the songs are about singing and giving.
Okay, you're talking in a more less technical way. Right now what I'm doing is I'm saying in a technical sense. We have categories of how to group the writings of the Bible. So some would fall as letters, some would fall, or epistles, some would fall as narrative, some falls as poetry, and in a technical sense, some of it is considered wisdom literature. So you're thinking in a more general sense. And so, in a sense, all of the Psalms contribute towards wisdom. But only some of the Psalms would be considered wisdom literature.
For a human.
Right, but...
We don't have the mind of God.
No, we don't.
That's what makes it always question things, because we can't see the
purpose. Right. But I'm just talking more specifically now about wisdom literature in itself. We're trying to categorize it. So we have this section of wisdom literature, but what we have to figure it out is how each one of them contributes to our understanding of wisdom. How does Job complement Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Psalms? Without trying to be overly simplistic, it seems that the book of Job contributes to our understanding of wisdom by offering a defense of wisdom in the light of seeming injustices. And we went through that last week. We touched on that. We went through chapters 12 through 14. Job's friends are saying, Job, we have wisdom here. Would you pay attention? Look up, kids. We always tell our kids, listen to me. I tell my kids all the time, say, Kirsty or Che, or you are four. I am 41. I have more wisdom than you. And I kind of say it like that sometimes. Sorry. And so we say that. And so Job's friends are doing this. And they're condescending. They are condescending. They're kind of, Job, listen to us. We have wisdom. And then Job says to them, oh, when you die, wisdom is going to die. He's being sarcastic. He says, I know the same things you know. And I know that wisdom dwells with God. I know all that. But then Job says, but that's my problem. I know God's not incompetent. He's not a bumbling executive. We've all heard of the guy who sits up there and doesn't know what he's doing. He's not a bumbling executive. He's wise. But that means God must be unjust. He's punishing me. And I didn't sin. And then his friends say, you did sin. And he says, where have I sinned? And they don't know what it is, but they know he sinned. And they go back and forth. So Job offers a defense of wisdom in the light of seeming injustices. When we come to the end, Job will acknowledge that God is wise, that he is just, and he will still worship him. So wisdom. You need to read chapters 12 through 14. Read Zophar's speech and then read 12 through 14 and listen to what Job is saying to his friends. There's the theme of justice. Beginning with God's early statement that Satan incited God against Job to destroy him without cause. The theme of justice threads its way through the entire book of Job, culminating with God's questions of Job in 48. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? And Job is saying, God's saying to Job, are you questioning my judgment, my ability to act fairly? But there's a lot of different words used, but they all come back to the one Hebrew word that we would spell out with the letters M-I-S-P-A-T, mispat. And those are behind a lot of what's going on here when we talk about judgment, justice. When Job says, I want to present my case. When he says, I wish someone would stand up for me as in a court of law and defend me. I want God to come and answer me. He's talking about this whole issue of justice, and he's talking about judicial justice. But God doesn't answer that when he talks in Job in the last speech. He says, this is not about punishment. We talked about this last week. This is about, I'm a sovereign, and I'm at liberty to test. So you're thinking of it as this. Okay, every time, and Job's friends are saying, okay, every time something bad happens, you've sinned. And Job is saying, no, it's not that, but that means God is judging me as a judge unfairly. And God's saying, you're in the wrong category. Come back over here. I'm a sovereign, and I am testing you. And it's a totally different category with total different reasons for why it's going on. And so we talked about that. So I like what the one guy says here. He says, God is acting as a ruler to test his subject, not as a judge to punish him for wrongdoing. So that. Now, mystery. The inclusion of mystery as a theme of Job is something which becomes evident upon completion of God's speeches. Since God never informs Job of the reason for his suffering, but he expects Job to still have faith. In other words, in light of the fact that there are no answers, Job still is not justified in not worshiping God. And then he still chooses to worship God. It's not the blind leap of faith when you serve God for no reason. Okay, I'm just going to launch out there. There still is a reason to worship God. But it's not in having answers. It's understanding mystery that's attached to God. Mystery requires faith, and faith is an expected response given the way that God powerfully and wisely governs created order. The concept of mystery in the book of Job, this is important to understand, is closely related to creation. You need to read the book of Job with creation in mind because it weaves its way throughout the book. In Job chapter 9, and that not just in the initial act of creation, but in how God handles the creation. It is a theme that comes attached to, and we're going to see this in a little bit, but it is the theme which is attached to the mysterious ways in which God does things in creative order that Job cannot understand. And it's tied closely to God's care and the way God takes care of and the way God sustains. In other words, mystery is closely attached to how God cares for us. In the book of Job, and especially the creation. So when you come to Job chapter 9, and he says, verse number 4, God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who hath hardened himself against him and prospered? He removes the mountains, and they do not know. When he overturns them in his anger, he shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun, and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens. And treads out on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yea, wonders without number. The theme isn't present all the time, but it's kind of hovering over the whole book of Job, creation. And creation, God uses creation to demonstrate the mystery surrounding his acts. Job, and let's go there briefly. What time is it? Okay. let's go to the end of the book where Job, where God speaks, Job chapter 38. I underappreciated how important creation is to the overall message of the book, and not just the act of creation, but the act of God keep sustaining it. But actually, let's see here. Oops, how did I get in the Psalms? Oh, brother, that would have done me no good. I almost started reading too, and you'd have been out there. What is he reading? Okay. Then the Lord answered Job out of the world, went and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you." Here's the creative act. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." So in other words, but he's not just doing it to hammer on Job, although he is hammering it. He's trying to do it to say, "Job, think about what I've done in creation and think about the mystery attached to creation. You can't answer those questions. You know what? Bring that over to your suffering. You can't answer those questions either. But think of how I take care of the created order and the mystery surrounding it. So even though there's mystery, it does not mean I'm not taking care of you. I am taking care of you." And he goes on, he says, "Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fashioned? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." And I could just imagine Job is, I can't even fathom this, to be honest with you. To be questioned by God verbally, and to be given these questions and to have no answers after you've demanded that God appear. Verse 12, "Have you commanded?" Now we're getting past the creation of it all to the sustaining of it all. "Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked shall be shaken out of it?" And so have you done all this? You know, and then he goes in, let's go into chapter number 39. Here's more. Now he's getting down to individual animals and creation. "Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? Can you do all this?" Verse 5, "Who will set the donkey, wild donkey free?" And blah, blah, blah. He goes on and on. I'm not meaning blah, blah, blah in the bad sense. I'm meaning it in the sense, Job, will the wild ox? But it's all about, he's telling, okay, they give birth. It's all things where God takes care of them, where God keeps them populating, where God feeds them. So it's not that God just threatening him with mystery. Who does all this? He's helping him by saying, "Look, I there's a lot of mystery you can't answer in relationship to the creation. But you know that I take care of it." And now he's saying to Job, in that context, then still worship me in light of the mystery of suffering. And so I think that mystery is so important. Overall purpose. The book of Job seems intent on wedding the wisdom of God to the justice of God by means of emphasizing the mystery attached to God's dealings with mankind. By means of this, it seeks to make the argument that no circumstance of life, no matter how baffling, humiliating, or painful, should stifle genuine worship of God born out of faith. We will never be able to stand in the judgment and say, I deserved the right to quit worshiping you. This book is trying to help us to understand how to keep worshiping God when we can't make sense of God and his ways in our life. Now this chart. Let's spend a few moments on this. These are some of the themes that I think, and I've related them to Job's friends, because I think the Job's friends and Job relate to these themes differently. I still think there's a lot of wealth of wisdom in this book for people who wish to be counselors and help others. I teach a lesson, it won't be in here probably, it'll come up, but on just counsel to the counselor from the book of Job and things that we all need to be aware of. But let's drop down to the first. In the middle there you see grace. It doesn't come out directly, but grace is just threaded throughout this. The whole idea of the theme of grace, the fact that God, the whole thing with Satan saying, Job does not worship you because he loves you, he worships you because you give him toys. And God's saying, no, this is an act of free, an act of grace on my part to give him blessings, and he responds to my grace freely. He worships me because of my grace. It's not just because he gets trinkets from me, and then Satan tests him. But grace when God finally appears, that's grace. Grace when God does not consume Job's friends. And he says, Job offers sacrifice. He was mad. There was wrath. And he would have consumed Job's friends for what they said. So grace is something that's throughout the whole book. The grace of God. Oh, and you can use that as you keep that in mind as you read. But from the perspective of Job's friends, we start here, and before, this is kind of like the point at which Job starts to suffer. Job is a worshiper of God. The friends are not yet on the scene. But then suffering comes into the mix. Suffering is right there. And when suffering comes, it puts Job in the situation in which he has to then think through his relationship to God, and he's having now struggles reconciling God's ways. So suffering comes in there in this. It's like all of us. We believe, we know we have faith. I know my theology and all that, and then something real happens to us, and then we have to evaluate our faith. When that happens, when suffering comes in, Job continues to affirm the wisdom of God, specifically as displayed in creation. But he now struggles with the justice of God, because justice is nothing more than the arbitrary decisions of the one in power. So up until suffering, he's worshiping God, no problem. Suffering comes, and now he maintains belief in the wisdom of God, but now suffering has to come between wisdom and justice. God is wise, but he can't be just. What brings them back together again? When God confronts him with mystery. Then Job continues to worship God. And his ideas of God are now reconciled again. He no longer is struggling with his conception of God between wisdom and justice. How about Job's friends? Job's friends. Suffering comes. They come in when the suffering has already occurred. They believe in justice. They don't struggle with justice like Job does. They believe in justice. But they conceive of justice as God's strict adherence to reward and retribution. You do good, God rewards you. You do bad, God smites you. And he does it right away. And that's where we're going. No. This isn't about a judge judging. This is about a ruler testing. But they don't get it. So now what do they struggle with? Freedom. This rigid conception of God's actions leaves no room for divine prerogative. Well, God might have a reason why he's not. And Job says this. He says, guys, look around you. And we could do this. Look around you. Do you see some wicked people prospering right now? Do you see a guy who's run Playboy Enterprises since he was in the 60s and he's now in his 80s living a totally pagan lifestyle his whole life and enjoying it? Hugh Hefner? Has he had suffering and all? No. Can you look around and see the fact? And Job's saying, guys, look. And now you're saying I'm being judged because I'm sinning? There's wicked people all around that are prospering. But they struggle with freedom. God doesn't always have to judge right away. He always will judge fairly, but he doesn't judge right away. But what then reconciles their understanding of God? His wrath at the end when he rebukes them and says, you've been speaking wrongly about me. They never confessed it as if Job did. The interesting thing about suffering is it differentiates between certainty and maturity. Maybe you know this. Have you ever met someone, and I was there, and I'm still there to a point, a young theologian or in school, and you know the one that's just getting ready to get married and says, you know what, this is going to happen in my household, and I'm going to do this, this, and this, and this, and they've got, and the kids will do this, and we'll go here, and we'll do this, and there's a lot of certainty about how things are going to work out. That's not always a reflection of maturity. And Job's friends are like that. Job, if you do this, this, and this, God will do this, this, and this, and everything will work out. Their faith was certain. Their theology was certain. It was nailed down, but it was very immature. And then at the end, Job has to sacrifice. Then at the end, so those are the themes and how I think they relate to each one. And then just real briefly here, if you bear with me for a minute, some definitions. I give you definitions of the key themes in Job. Please take time to read these. Freedom. Like, what do I mean by God is free? Let's just touch on that one, because I think there's probably different understandings of what it means to be God is free. When freedom is spoken of as a theme in Job, this is not the equivalent of saying that God is free to do whatever he desires apart from any constraint. It is true that nothing outside of God is able to constrain him, but it is equally true that God is constrained in his freedom by his own character. So, let's start right there with freedom. God is free to do what is consistent with his character. God is not constrained by any outside force. So that is a comfort in Job, because immediately I'm sitting there thinking, okay, so God isn't just some Greek God sitting up there, taking his finger and stirring up the scene with mankind and just to have fun with us. God isn't free like that. This becomes evident in God's closing arguments against Job when, in the midst of baffling Job with his wisdom and subduing him with thoughts of his power, he reminds Job of his concern for that which he has created. He is concerned about his creation. To say, therefore, that God is free is to say that he is not fettered in his actions by anything other than his own nature. Remember that. And remember that when you are suffering. God is free, but that does not mean that God is turned the earth into a giant playpen in which he just toys with us and picks on us like a kid, a mean kid with his toys. You know how a kid one minute will love their dolly and the next minute... That's not God. He isn't picking us up one minute and coddling us, and the next minute turning us over and smacking us. God, so read those others as well. Next week we'll give you some material on the prologue, and then we'll hopefully have more time for discussion. I wanted to get started that way, so at least we can all start on the same page. Bring your notebooks, and I'll have more to stuff next week. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.